Business development companies, or BDCs, are playing an increasingly important role for investors seeking income, diversification, and access to private credit markets. But there are still plenty of questions to explore, including how are recent innovations in BDC structure shaping the opportunity for investors? How are interest rate cycles, economic headwinds, and regulatory changes impacting the sectors? And what should investors know about credit quality, deal flow, and what may be ahead for BDCs in the months and years to come?
We're seeing a lot of really interesting opportunities in the BDC space today. And we've seen a lot of growth of the asset class. And there are a lot of really great brands in the BDC space today. But what we're finding is brand name does not always translate into outcome.
That was Joe Mazzoli, head of investor relations and client development at Barings BDC. And this is Streaming Income, a podcast from Barings. I'm your host, Greg Campion. Coming up on the show, understanding the current state of play and opportunity in BDCs. Before we get into the conversation, remember you can follow Streaming Income on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and if you'd like to watch the video episodes, on YouTube as well. And don't forget to follow Barings on LinkedIn, where you can subscribe to our monthly newsletter, Where Credit Is Due, where we spotlight people and portfolios across asset classes from high yield and private credit to everything in between. With that, please enjoy this conversation with Joe Mazzoli. Joe Mazzoli, welcome to Streaming Income.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Excited to have you here. I feel like you are a well-known man around the firm. Everybody knows Joe, and I feel like all of our clients, certainly who interact with us on the BDC side of things, recognize your face and know all your expertise. So it's super exciting to finally have you here and have this conversation.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, so where I want to start is kind of defining our terms a little bit. And I don't want this to be a 101 conversation. We've done 101 BDC content before. Actually, I will give you a pop quiz to start this podcast off. Do you know what our number one most viewed YouTube video on the Barings channel is?
It's got to be something that you're moderating, I'm sure, but no, I don't know the answer to that one.
It's not. It's your 2 or 3 minute overview of what is a BDC.
Wow.
With something like 33,000 views. Now, I will say that our new firm brand video, which features CEO Mike Freno and all the other leadership, has 32,000 views. So you're upstaging the CEO. I don't know if that's a great look.
That's not a good thing.
That one is rising quickly though. So I think you may not be in the lead for that long. But anyways, that's a long-winded way of saying, let's hit some terms up front. Let's kind of set the stage a little bit. But then I want to spend the bulk of this conversation talking about, I think, what we're tentatively titling this episode, the current state of play in BDC. So really getting into what's actually going on in this market. But start us at a high level. What is a BDC? And then maybe we'll talk a little bit about the different types of BDCs that exist.
Yeah, absolutely. So a BDC, it's an acronym for business development company. And it's really just a fund structure, right? This, we talk about the BDC industry, right? But BDCs are really just access points to private credit.
Yeah.
And in our case, the BDCs that we manage at Barings are access points to a roughly $50 billion private finance business.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of transparency in terms of the way these structures operate. They're 40 Act funds. They file quarterly, just like any public company does, 10Qs, 10Ks. So it's really just a fund structure. And there's several types of BDCs, which I think we'll get into in a moment, but it's an access point to the platform.
Got it. Okay, cool. Well, let's dive right in. Tell me about the different types of BDCs that exist out there, maybe how that's kind of evolved a little bit over time.
So we have public BDCs, which are publicly traded closed-end funds, essentially. There are private BDCs, which are fully private funds. They raise capital via drawdown structures, capital call structures, mm-hmm. with the target of some sort of liquidity event into the future or a wind down period at the end of the reinvestment period. And then there's perpetual BDCs. semi-liquid evergreen offerings. And the perpetual BDCs have seen the most growth in the market recently. These funds accept, in most cases, monthly subscriptions and then offer quarterly liquidity, generally up to 5% of the total size of the fund. And I think that's where we've seen the most growth in recent periods.
Mm-hmm. And I'm curious two things, actually. What's been driving that growth on the perpetual side of things? And are you seeing any type of investor type in particular driving that growth? And then I'm also curious around kind of geographically, if you're seeing any different trends kind of geographically in terms of those structures.
Yeah, I think the growth of the semi-liquid evergreen structures, perpetual BDCs, is driven by a few things, but I think the most important driver of that growth is really the ability for an investor to step into a fully ramped, fully diversified portfolio, earning that return profile in the first month of the investment.
Okay.
And that's really powerful, right? Because a lot of times closed-end funds can have a really great IRR or a really great track record, but the reality is investor may have had to wait 18 or 24 months for their capital to be fully called, right? Okay. So that investor didn't really earn that return. Whereas for a semi-liquid evergreen structure, perpetual BDC, that investor is actually earning the return that the fund is generating almost
day
one.
Got it.
And then from an investor type perspective, mm-hmm. I think the semi-liquid evergreen strategies are really attractive to the wealth channel because historically it's been really tough for a wealth channel investor to lock up capital for 7 years or whatever it might be for a closed-end strategy. But also we've seen institutional investors sort of realize that, you know, the J curve is real. And it's really hard to sort of make up that lost opportunity mm-hmm. cost of being underinvested in the early years of the investment. So I think we're seeing all types of investors access perpetual BDCs. And from a geographic perspective, it's also really, really diverse. Of course, the US market is very strong, very large. South America, LATAM, Middle East, Asia Pacific, Australia. So it's really all over the world that we're seeing interest in the asset class.
Yeah, well, that is a great way to kind of like level set us and kind of help us define our terms. I was very curious specifically on that geographic element, I think, to start. So let's dive into a little bit of more kind of current dynamics, what's going on with the asset class. I want to kind of start with the macro because there's a lot of focus right now, especially on what's going on with interest rates. So let's maybe talk a little bit about that. I guess, you know, in the US, we've just had our first rate cut. Looks like we may be on the path to the second one, maybe another one before year end. In Europe, they're a little further along in that rate cutting cycle. But it seems like we've, at least in the US here, we've hit an inflection point. Maybe this is a new interest rate regime, so there may be lower rates on the horizon. What does that mean for BDCs, and how should investors kind of be thinking about that dynamic?
Yeah, I mean, look, these are primarily portfolios of floating rate private corporate loans, and these loans are priced at a spread to SOFR. And as base rates come down, SOFR, of course, is the base rate. So that is a return headwind for the asset class broadly. But I think that's sort of okay because we do live in a world of relatives, right? Meaning, you know, what is our goal as private credit lenders within our BDC strategies? Our goal is to deliver an attractive return relative to public markets. We're capturing an illiquidity premium. And I think we've done that quite well over a long period of time. But our goal is also to deliver an attractive return relative to our peers. Mm-hmm. And so I think relative to public markets, you look at high yield bond, yield to worst today is sort of in the mid 6%. Investment grade bonds are near 4%. So I think against that backdrop of bond spreads near all-time tights, public equity markets near all-time highs, I think a little bit of return headwind, given slightly lower base mm-hmm, rates, mm-hmm. is sort of okay. And I think investors will still view the asset class as attractive, certainly from a diversification perspective, but also from a relative value, absolute return perspective.
Yeah, got it.
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah, spreads are very, we were just having this conversation with the high yield team the other day, and you know, spreads are obviously very tight everywhere as we record this right now. And I think their view was that, you know, actually spreads can potentially stay tight for a long time. So that, but your point is well taken in terms of it's all relative. And all of these fixed income asset classes are gonna, that's a headwind, I guess, for all of them. Let's talk a little just about the economy in general. So we're probably hearing like a little bit less worry these days about tariffs. That seems to have calmed down a little bit. Who knows, that could kind of pick up again as kind of the rubber hits the road. But hearing a little bit less worries and concern about that right now. We're hearing a little bit more about this kind of idea of like a two-speed economic expansion, right? So if you look at like the latest GDP numbers, I was looking at the Atlanta GDP Now estimate the other day, and it was hovering around 4%, which is, you know, considering the headlines we see, like incredibly strong. Like, you know, it's not sort of an equally distributed economic expansion. Our colleague Trevor Slavin talked about this recently on one of his markets calls, where he was basically saying, you know, if you're Mag 7 and you're spending, you know, hundreds of millions or billions on AI build out, and all these companies are customers of each other, essentially the B2B economy in a certain part of the world, most specifically tech, is super strong. Whereas if you look at, for instance, you know, the lower kind of tier consumer, you're starting to see things like delinquencies pick up and things like that. So it doesn't feel like a very evenly spread, robust economic expansion right now. But with that as kind of the backdrop, I don't know if you would agree with how I just characterized all of that, but with that as kind of the backdrop, how does that then feed through to the underlying asset class that makes up BDCs?
Yeah, I think you made some great points, and I agree with that, right? That it appears that there are some cracks, particularly on the lower end of the consumer. I think different BDCs, different managers are operating in different segments of the market, and also focusing on different industries within their portfolios. And if we kind of rewind back to 2015, 2016, when the price of oil dropped from $100 a barrel to $30 per barrel, there were some private credit managers that are, you know, very large private credit managers to this day and very active in the BDC space, that suffered tremendously because they had 10 to 20% of their portfolio invested in oil and gas and energy. But for us at Barings, we have always taken a more conservative approach to industry selection. Since the inception of our senior loan strategy in 2012, we have always avoided industries that have experienced higher default rates historically. It's always the same industries that sort of get into trouble.
It's a cyclical, highly cyclical industries.
Whenever there's a bump in the road. And so for us, we avoid at the very top of our deal filter consumer-facing businesses. We don't lend to restaurants, retail, consumer end markets. We don't lend to oil and gas or commodity-linked sectors. So we've always preferred that more conservative approach. And so as we look at our portfolio kind of holistically, we don't really believe that we have any sort of meaningful exposure or concern to those, to that two-speed that you mentioned. The lower end of the consumer, or quite frankly, even the higher end of the consumer, just because we're not really active in the consumer market.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think thinking about it kind of going in, and yes, I've had this conversation with other folks on this podcast before, this concept of avoiding like the fad industries, avoiding the super highly cyclical industries, and that just being kind of standard operating business. And, you know, maybe you give away some upside during the good times, but, you know, as we know, credit asset classes are kind of about outperforming on the loss, right? And so, there's something to be said for investing in these quote unquote boring businesses, right?
There's an asymmetrical kind of upside downside when it comes to credit investing, right? I mean, best case scenario, we receive our interest, then we receive our principal back at the end of the term, and that's our goal, that's what we want. you know, in theory, worst case scenario, a lender could suffer significant losses if they were exposed to one of these highly cyclical industries, if the recovery prospects for a particular company diminished due to a cyclical, a period of down cycle.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. All right, well, let's get into this kind of concept of credit quality and valuations maybe in a little bit more detail. So various headlines out there, popping up with different concerns and things like that. So a couple of concerns I've been seeing lately. There's some concerns around declining net investment income, tighter spreads, which we referenced already, and rising non-accruals. First of all, can you help translate that into English for us and then tell us if you're concerned about that?
Yeah, well, look, declining net investment income just for BDCs broadly, right? That would mean lower return profile, mm-hmm. right? Net investment income, one way to think of this is it's essentially income before credit losses, mm-hmm. which, assuming the manager does a good job of limiting or minimizing any sort of credit loss or net asset value declines within the portfolio, then the net investment income, that yield, that return profile is reflective of the return that the investor is realizing. So net investment income headwinds, yes, when base rates decline, and they have declined modestly in recent periods, we'll see the path of base rates is always uncertain. We'll see where base rates go from here. I think if we had this conversation in the middle of 2023, everybody thought we were going to be in a recession in the fourth mm-hmm. quarter of 23, mm-hmm. right? So base rates were certainly going lower. That didn't happen. Now base rates are on the decline, and they probably will continue to decline, but we likely will be in a somewhat higher base rate environment for longer relative to what we saw after the great financial crisis all the way through 2021.
Mm-hmm.
So I think with that, let's call it 3-4% base rates, I still think the private credit asset class will deliver an attractive return. And again, it's an attractive risk-adjusted return relative to public market returns.
Yep. Yep.
And then, of course, peers.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think NII will be okay just because of the world of relatives. Now, non-accruals, that relates to the credit loss mm-hmm, spectrum, right? Mm-hmm. So NII is income before credit losses. Non-accruals is maybe a metric of risk of credit losses within the portfolio.
Mm.
And I think non-accruals for the industry broadly are still quite low, certainly in the Barings portfolios. However, I think there have been some cracks. Manager selection does matter. And at times, unfortunately, especially for certain BDCs that have more retail-oriented fee structures, it's those fee structures have forced some of those managers into riskier investments.
Mm.
Because in order for that manager to generate to pay themselves that fee,
mm-hmm.
and then also generate a return to the underlying investor, the managers really had to stretch for yield on the risk spectrum at the asset level.
Mm.
And so I think in those situations, we have seen some losses within some private credit portfolios. So BDC is a broad term, and the manager behind that BDC makes a lot of difference.
Mm. Okay, know your manager. So let me just ask you a quick follow-up on that. If you're assessing managers and you want to understand how their fee structure works and whether or not it's sort of incentivizing them to take excessive risk, is there a particular question you should ask or a particular thing you should be looking for?
Well, I think hurdle rates are very important, right? Hurdle rates for the incentive fee. A lot of managers, I would even say most managers in the perpetual BDC space have 5% hurdle rates, meaning the manager has to exceed that hurdle to earn an incentive fee.
Okay.
5% is very, very low, especially in today's environment.
Hmm.
But also that 5% hurdle rate for our peers, it's an income-based hurdle rate. Income-based meaning even if the manager experiences credit losses or if net asset value declines, it doesn't change the incentive fee that manager is paying themselves. So I would describe that as really another form of a base fee.
Mm-hmm.
And that's more of a retail fee structure.
Mm.
And so I think the level of the incentive fee hurdle rate is very important. The absolute level of fees is also important. The share of the pie.
Mm-hmm.
And I think all of these things are captured in the total return over time, but it may not be so obvious quarter to quarter.
Mm. Got it. Okay. So definitely worth really digging into and really understanding how every manager is operating, because it sounds like there's some differences out there. We hear a little bit about some managers out there relying on debt to maintain distributions. Is that something you're seeing a lot of? Is that troubling? Not to get too hyper negative here, but this is one of the concerns that pops up.
Look, another way to describe that, using debt to fund distributions, it's a situation where a manager is under earning the distribution, right? Because if the distribution is above the earnings profile of the underlying fund,
you need to pay it from somewhere.
Then that's right. And so I think we have seen a little bit of this, right? If you look at the 1 year returns of some of the BDCs in the market today, those 1 year returns are below the current annualized distribution rate.
Hmm.
And so, you know, very high level analysis, right? That of course means that the manager is under earning the distribution. We have seen some distributions come down. I think we'll see more.
Mm-hmm.
Again, that's not necessarily the end of the world, but I think the investor needs to consider the actual return that is being earned, right? Because the distribution yield can sort of be an attractive marketing tool for certain managers.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really the total return that the investor is realizing.
Mm-hmm.
And so matching the distribution with the total return, the annualized return of the fund over time is really important, especially when a manager is seeking net asset value per share stability over time.
Mm, got it. Okay. Another thing that's coming up these days is PIK, payment in kind. So tell me just broadly how you're thinking about PIK. And, you know, I'll mention actually we're just put out a newsletter. We have a LinkedIn newsletter called Where Credit Is Due. So if listeners and viewers are watching this, go check that out. We just did a newsletter that focused quite a bit on PIK and how the team is thinking about PIK. But give us kind of high level, broad strokes, what your view is on PIK.
I do believe that there is good PIK, there is bad PIK, right? Or maybe, I don't know, good PIK is maybe not necessarily the right word, but not all PIK is bad, right? And the bad PIK would be a situation where a company was underperforming within a portfolio and the company wasn't able to generate enough cash flow to service the cash interest on the loan.
Mm-hmm.
A manager may restructure that transaction to add PIK, payment in kind, to that particular transaction. That might be considered bad PIK because it's indicative of stress within a portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
Now, typically that loan would already be marked down in the portfolio to reflect whatever stress the borrower may be experiencing. But that's what could be considered bad PIK.
Sure. Yep.
Good PIK or PIK that's structured originally as PIK when the loan was originated, it's not necessarily bad. It's a tool that can be used to provide a little bit of flexibility for the issuer. And I think we are seeing different segments of the market utilize PIK in different ways,
mm-hmm.
meaning this large corporate segment of private credit. Some private credit managers are lending to really, really big companies, companies with $200-400 million of EBITDA. And it's not that big companies are bad, but it's just a lot more competitive in that segment of the market.
Mm.
Those private credit managers are competing directly with a $1.5 trillion public loan market.
Right, right.
And so as a result, for those large corporate private credit managers to win deal flow from the large corporate or from the public broadly syndicated loan market, they are offering a lot more PIK. So that's why you see more PIK within the large corporate segment of private credit versus the core middle of the middle market, the traditional segment of private credit where Barings continues to focus.
Got it. Okay, so like most things we've talked about here so far, you sort of have to like look below the headline because it's not just like, okay, there's an increase in PIK. I think the first gut reaction most people have is, okay, that's a sign of stress, which may be true. But to your point, there may be other situations where it is appropriate, but then you're getting into the whole dynamic of, well, you're competing against the BSL market and, you know, what kind of concessions are you giving and all that kind of stuff. So it's a complicated area, but it's notable that we've seen a rise there. And
I would say in the large corporate segment of private credit, PIK interest as a percentage of investment income is roughly 6 to 6.5%.
Okay.
So PIK interest as a percentage of investment income. Within the core middle market, we're seeing core middle market portfolios closer to 4%.
Okay.
PIK interest as a percentage of investment income.
Interesting.
So it's
more at the larger end you're seeing
it? It's more at the larger end. And again, that percentage is maybe something for investors to watch the trend over time to identify situations where PIK may be increasing.
Okay, cool. All right, let's move along to talk a little bit about deal flow and origination, because I know that's a really big deal in private credit, broadly speaking. So let's talk a little bit about, you see a lot of headlines around M&A and what's going on with the M&A environment. We've been kind of living in this muted M&A environment, you know, for the last several years. Potentially seeing signs of life. I think if you look at the last quarter or two, you started to see things happen. But there's a lot of question marks around what's the sustainability of that? Is there still too much uncertainty around tariffs and regulations and everything else to really see a true kind of resurgence in M&A? But I guess how is the current M&A environment kind of impacting your outlook?
Well, look, I agree with your assessment. I mean, I think year after year, it seems that M&A advisors and investment banks are kind of saying, this is the year, right? We're going to have this this big flood of deal activity. And I don't think we've seen a big flood, or anybody in the market has seen a big flood, but I think we have seen a thawing. Mm-hmm. And my view is we may not have a big flood, right? Mm-hmm. But this thawing will continue. And I think part of the challenge was that private equity sellers of businesses were holding on, of course, to 2021 valuations.
Sure, sure.
Buyers, of course, wanted discounts in the higher interest rate environment. I think we are closer to a middle ground today, and we're seeing more deal flow as a result. For the first half of 25, for example, within our private credit business, we're up quite significantly year over year. I think it was about 30% higher for the first half. And I think that's really a result of some of that thawing.
Just in terms of transaction activity?
In terms of volume.
Yeah.
So I think that will continue, but I don't really expect a big surge. And maybe as base rates decline moderately, that will increase appetite for M&A. But if base rates were to decline dramatically, which I don't expect, but some sort of dramatic decline in base rates, if that were to happen, probably would be associated with some sort of fear or negative economic event, which probably also wouldn't drive a lot of transaction activity.
Yeah.
So I think some of the tariff noise is behind us. I mean, we'll see if the full, what happens is the full impact flows through the economy. For us, we believe we don't have a lot of exposure in our business. We're primarily domestically focused, also services portfolios. So these companies are not really sourcing goods or materials abroad in any meaningful way. But I think that thawing will continue, and that'll be net positive to private credit deal flow broadly.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think the other thing is like, you don't really need a massive M&A boom to effectively and efficiently deploy capital if, and this is kind of a big if you are a large established manager with a, you know, established portfolio. I think I'll probably get the numbers exactly wrong, but I think something like 60%, 60 to 70% of our investment activity on the Barings private finance platform over the last several years has been add-on transactions and other opportunities that come out of the existing portfolio. So that's kind of a big factor as well.
It's a huge factor. And so I'd say in 2023, just to emphasize the numbers that you just mentioned, in 2023, I think roughly 70% of all private credit deal flow for the market broadly was coming from add-on transactions. Mm-hmm. In 2024, and these numbers are also consistent with what we've experienced at Barings, in 2024, roughly 60% of deal flow is coming from add-ons. 25, you know, I'd call it 50 to 60% is coming from add-on activity. So that number has trended down, but add-ons continue to be really important in allocating capital in this sort of market environment. And those lenders that are large, incumbent, have large existing portfolios like Barings benefit in that sort of environment. And also add-on transactions are pretty attractive because we're lending to businesses that we already know well, we like.
Yep.
We're helping those businesses become more diversified by geography, more diversified by customer base. And typically they come with additional equity from private equity sponsors.
Yeah, 100%. You've already, in many cases, been lending to these companies for years and years, and you know them, you know the management teams really well, and you can make that a really informed decision if I want to make this loan, or maybe if I don't want to make this loan based on the experience that you've had so far. So that's a huge factor, probably doesn't get talked about enough. Let's talk a little bit about sponsor-driven versus non-sponsored lending. Traditionally, I think about at least the Barings direct lending platform, very sponsor focused, but tell me that, like, from a BDC industry perspective and kind of how you're thinking about the differentiation there.
Within our BDC franchise at Barings, you're right, the majority of the portfolios are sponsor backed, right? But at a high level, we sort of think of the portfolio strategies as 75 to 85% sponsor backed, and then 15 to 25% coming from non-sponsored origination channels. And having the flexibility to evaluate relative value across sponsored and non-sponsored is an important kind of differentiator in our mind, because there are a lot of private credit firms operating in the sponsor channel. I mean, of course, it is really attractive to partner with private equity firms that we know really well, who we've been partnering with for, you know, over a decade in many cases. And also we know how those private equity firms will act in the event something doesn't go as planned.
Yep.
We'll support the underlying portfolio companies with equity and act as true partners in some sort of downside scenario. But in the non-sponsored channel, where we're sourcing transactions through intermediaries, M&A advisors, boutique investment banks, at times there can be really attractive opportunities from a risk-adjusted return perspective. Now, you don't have the same level of partnership in the ownership structure on the other side of the, of the table there, but I think as a platform, having the ability to be flexible and nimble in that segment of the market is a differentiator.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think the caveat there probably is, if you're going to go into that non-sponsored space, you need to make sure you have really robust underwriting credit chops in-house, right? Because everything we talked about earlier in this conversation, just in terms of risk mitigation, is kind of what trumps all in credit asset classes like this. All right, last question around kind of big trends out there. Asset-based finance. I don't know if there's much overlap here with BDCs here, but I'm actually just curious because we're seeing just this surge of interest in asset-based finance. Barings is involved in many different, I guess what you call sub-asset classes that could be considered asset-based finance, whether it's infrastructure debt, whether it's, you know, some of the asset classes, even like portfolio finance and many others. How are you thinking about that? Is there a kind of overlap between the two, or not so much?
Well, I would put it like this. Asset-based finance is a very broad term. Right? I mean, you mentioned several different kind of groups and strategies within Barings that could fit within asset-based finance. I think some asset-based finance strategies that we see in the market can have more cyclical retail consumer elements to them. So there's kind of a different underlying risk exposure.
Of course. You have credit card receivables and all that kind of stuff.
That's right. And within our BDC franchise, we do have some exposure, fairly modest, but we believe we're generating very attractive risk-adjusted returns in certain spots where we're lending against accounts receivable, inventory, equipment, well within the liquidation value of the underlying collateral. And having those sort of, we would consider that more acyclical rather than just traditional cash flow lending. We view that as sort of further diversification within the portfolio.
Yeah, awesome. All right, cool. We covered a ton of ground here, got a little bit technical, but I think hopefully all this was very valuable for listeners. I know I've definitely learned a lot. Let's talk about kind of where we go from here. So take this in any way you want to go, whether it's talking about kind of continued growth in non-traded BDCs, whether it's talking about anything on the regulatory front, whether it's talking about AI. What's next? What's next for BDCs?
Well, I think on the regulatory front, I mean, look, there's been an evolution in the BDC space over the past 10 or 20 years. I think that evolution will continue, and regulation is part of the evolution, not all of the evolution, but the asset class has institutionalized significantly over the past decade or two for the benefit of investors. It's fee structures, quality of the managers involved in the BDC space, all of the above. There are some rules, particularly as it relates to public BDCs, that hopefully could evolve that would benefit the asset class. And I think we'll see how some of that develops. As it relates to AI, I mean, I think, you know, there's a lot going on with AI, of course. And, you know, the way that we view this is in general, we think there'll be a lot of efficiencies within the underlying portfolio companies that we're lending to. So we view it as sort of a tailwind. And then within our private credit business, I think and I know that, you know, senior leaders here, of course, are viewing AI as something to be leveraged to increase efficiency. I think just like every business everywhere, we are evolving, we are getting better, and AI will be a part of that.
Yeah, cool. And are you expecting more? We've talked about perpetual BDCs. At the top of this conversation, do you expect kind of things to keep shifting more in that direction? Do you think perpetual will kind of gain share relative to private BDCs and publicly traded BDCs?
Yes. Yeah. And they already have, right? Yeah. The capital that's been raised in perpetual BDC semi-liquid structures over the last 4 years has been significantly greater than public or private BDCs. And I think the reason for that is some of the things we mentioned earlier, right? The liquidity optionality, quarterly liquidity in most cases, up to 5% of the total size of these funds, monthly subscriptions, the ability to invest in a fully ramped, fully diversified portfolio, earning that return profile day one. And so I think the growth will continue in that segment of the market. And I think we've seen a lot of traditional asset managers looking for a way to sort of step into this segment of the market. And I think the asset class broadly is robust, it's resilient, it's acted as the diversification tool that it is through periods of volatility. But then within the asset class, again, there is a divergence of returns and outcomes. So I think there will always be relative winners and losers. And, you know, those managers that are the winners from a risk-adjusted return perspective will attract capital and will continue to grow.
Awesome. Well, it's going to be a super interesting space to watch, and it's fun to watch you and your team kind of right in the middle of it. And like I said up front, I think anyone who's interacting with Barings in the BDC space is seeing Joe's face probably and knows him well. So I appreciate the opportunity to get you here today and to kind of get a sense of what's going on in this market. That it's been a fun one to watch. It's going to continue to be a fun one to watch. And I think you're a great representative for the firm to be out there talking to our clients about this. So thank you, Joe, for joining today.
No, it's really an honor. Thank you so much, Greg.
Thanks again for listening to or watching this episode of Streaming Income. If you'd like to stay up to date on our latest insights across asset classes ranging from high yield to private credit, make sure to follow us and leave a review on your favorite podcast platform. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, and more. And remember to follow Barings on LinkedIn and subscribe to our newsletter, Where Credit Is Due, to see our latest updates. Thanks again for tuning in, and see you next time.